Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Welcome to the Legion Podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Legion on FX. I'm Jason.
And I'm Jim.
And I'm Aaron.
And this is the Legion Podcast episode 6. For a change of pace in this episode, Jim will psychoanalyze Aaron. Go.
Oh, boy. why do you isolate yourself from people, Aaron?
I wasn't aware that I did that.
That's classic denial. Okay, let's move on to
definitely
top 3 highlights for season 1, episode 6, chapter 6. First, what do you guys think?
I actually really like this episode. My number one here kind of bleeds all the way into how I felt about the episode, which is I was able to get my bearings quite a bit in this one, and I felt like it was grounding. You know, as we're coming to the end of the season, it needs to be a little bit more grounded. We need to understand the stakes here. And I think we're really starting to in this episode. So I really like this one.
It's cool. Yeah. I mean, when you first say that, I'm like, really? Because it was just a whole different reality. But then again, it totally does make sense because we can kind of get a feel for what's going on, right? What this malevolent character is trying to do.
Right. And you also get a sense of like what is probably the illusion and what is probably the real world. Mm-hmm. I think it's starting to ground us a little bit more.
Yep. Yeah, I agree. I like this episode a lot more just because it wasn't doing the is it real or not. It's 99% unreal.
Yeah.
And that kind of frees them to stop, you know, with the, you know, pussyfooting about the nature of reality and get down to telling a story. In fact, I think some of my favorite minutes in the entire season were in the first 15 minutes where they're doing the individual therapy sessions. And we got such a condensed look into the background and personality of these characters. Mm-hmm. That had been previously kind of thinly just kind of sketches or costumes or powers. Now they're actually becoming people. And I like that. And so I also thought the high fantasy sequences aren't as kind of distracting or pretentious seeming when, you know, they have a reason to exist. Like, you know, they showed the demon reveling in destructive powers last week. They showed the demon reveling and fucking with people's minds this week, and it all is of a piece. So, you know, go crazy with the James Bond visuals. But I most of the frustration I feel with Legion is when they're spending the majority of the time trying to trick me into stuff that I don't even think it's that great of a trick. And when they just get down to tell a story, I'm much more engaged. What do you think, Jason?
No, I pretty much agree. There was a moment, you know, during that first montage of psychoanalytic sessions where I at least entertained the idea that, oh, you know, maybe this is actually reality, because, you know, talking to Melanie Bird saying, so you concocted this fantasy of your guy being frozen because you miss him. And I guess I never really thought, oh yeah, this is what it's really been the whole time, but at least entertain the idea of that, you know. I mean, maybe in a movie that might be the twist, but for this show, you know that, no, this is just, none of this is real. But anyway, I liked this episode a lot. It was a little calmer than most and more, I don't know, just had some small moments and some humor that I laughed out loud a couple of times. And, it was a change of pace in a lot of different ways. So I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it a lot.
Speaking of wondering about the reality of, you know, these scenes here in the hospital, do you think that any of it is tied up with the beginning where David is, you know, questioning aloud, maybe the hospital stuff was the only stuff that's real? Could it, could it possibly be that none of the hospital stuff has been real from the beginning?
I think that could be a possibility, but it would be kind of annoying.
Yeah, I'm actually just proposing it as, you know, kind of an open-ended question. I don't think I believe that.
Right.
But
the one thing I'm wondering about is, so in this episode, Lenny says, oh, call me Lenny. We've known each other since the womb. And so that was a bit of a revelation. Now it sort of confirms that this demon has been a parasite since the womb, but also that her, I guess, true name is Lenny. I mean, I don't know if that's really what she meant to say, but that's what it seemed like, which then begs the question, okay, well then who was Lenny? Because I always kind of just thought, okay, if there was one real Lenny that she's taking on the visage of, it was the one in Clockworks that was killed by Sid when she was in David's body. And now I'm sort of questioning that, like, what really happened there?
Yeah, I was on that a week or two ago, that I'm starting to question whether Lenny, as she's constructed in the Aubrey Plaza version, actually was a real character at all.
Right. Still don't know.
So I don't know. Do you want me to go first? Because my first highlight is the actual first scene in the episode.
Go.
So this individual therapy session I was talking about in the beginning, I really like it because what I think was so great about Lenny or the Yellow-Eyed Demon's use of this is like how insane most of these powers are and how their situations do correspond to maladjusted personality types.
Yeah.
Like, you know, Melanie can't get over the loss of her husband. She's literally, you know, that's the classic stereotype of someone who hasn't changed their look or their home or anything for 20 years. And, you know, and they've envisioned this frozen, unavailable husband to hide the fact that they're the one that's stuck. And Ptolemy's, you know, had this mother who just dropped dead out of the blue in this, you know, kind of idyllic existence. And now he can only examine his memories, and he's stuck in the past and he can't get out of this loop. And the Carries have this, you know, textbook unhealthy attachments, this codependent relationship. Mm-hmm. And the Eye is this, you know, kind of hostility with like this little bit of a little man syndrome or little boy syndrome. And then Sid is, you know, dangerously isolated. I thought that was really good. And I can see why you said that you might have thought it was grounded in reality, because, you know, I thought the way Aubrey Plaza played this was kind of like the patient but long-suffering therapist who was dealing with these kind of deluded patients and trying to gently nudge them. And the kind of the malevolence didn't come out until later. But I just thought it was great, and especially to the extent that we got more about Ptolemy, especially, and the Carries and how they felt, and just anything at all from the Eye, I thought was really great.
It's interesting that the Eye was a part of this. It sort of confirms that the Eye and the demon are not in league, because the Eye is on the same playing field as everybody else, an outsider.
The demon does like the Eye, though?
Right. Walter gets it.
Right. Right. Yeah.
But and that's, yeah, I don't...
The ironic thing about that is, you know, Melanie does the opposite. I think what Lenny's trying to do here is to pathologize everybody so that she can be the source of their therapy, their well-being, and keep them kind of spinning in this thing. And what Melanie tried to do was say, no, none of this is because of your mental illness. It's because of your powers. So, and I think it's somewhere in between, but the one person who I do think they could all probably use some therapy, but the one person who really could use the most therapy of all these, in my opinion, is Walter, who she says, you know, you're angry, but maybe you're just angry at yourself or something, like you're isolated by the world. And it's ironic because he's the one that she actually admires the most and says gets it. So, but what do you guys think about that? Like, I mean, do you agree that she's, I mean, I actually think real therapy can do this sometimes. It can put you in this mindset of pathologizing your habits, and sometimes in ways that they actually don't need to be.
Probably bad therapy.
Yeah, bad therapy. Yeah, bad therapy. And yeah. So I think that's kind of what she's doing here. She's a bad therapist. She's trying to keep them dependent on her and thinking right. of themselves as broken.
Yeah, because it's funny because I've been through a quite a bit of therapy myself, and I've seen several therapists. And I said while I was watching this, I was like, Jesus, she's being awfully directive, which is like if you find a therapist seeming like the pushing a pet theory on you or saying like I'm not so sure this mm-hmm. girl you're seeing is pet, like right. like no really good therapist would make declarative statements. They would ask you how you're feeling and how do you feel around this person, and you know, like what are, but they would never be like, oh, you should stop seeing this person, or this is your problem and you're just too stupid to see it. And but it's insidious because, you know, if you have a therapist that would do that, like they're in this position of trust, they know all your secrets and they've had training presumably. And, you know, it's also kind of interesting how often therapists are damaged people themselves, because that's why they got into sure. the field. You know, they want to give back. So, and to what extent did they bring some of their issues into the room?
Right. I used to work at this literary agency where right. some of our clients were people who wrote self-help books, and like the guy who wrote the book about healing anxiety with herbs would always call and leave messages like, you guys have been promoting other clients this week, and I think you've forgotten about me, you know, just like everyone.
Yeah, take an herb. Yeah, take an herb, dude. Exactly. But it's funny because like it's very very rarely that any kind of mental health is portrayed in a positive manner in especially American society. Mm-hmm. Like it seems like it's always in the couch of like a person put in a mental asylum against their will, or a therapist conniving and taking advantage of them, or robbing them of their power. And this, and here it's like literally a demonic influence. I wonder if Noah Hawley's a Scientologist. I have to look into that.
There's been speculation about that, but
no kidding, because that would actually make a lot of damn sense.
Well, I think it was debunked.
Okay,
but people were talking about it, especially in those first episodes with the e-meter-like devices. But yeah, I think you know, our mental, I don't know, our, you could say weaknesses often, like this guy, the eye, he's overcompensating for having developed late as a kid by being extra aggressive right now. You know, we all, this is probably getting out of the scope of podcasting, but I just want to say, so we all sort of,
are we going to talk about uncircumcised dicks again?
No, I promise.
Cause I don't know.
Maybe
don't
later
know
on in the email section.
I don't know if we need to go down that, but okay.
But you know, like I got a, email for, or not an email, a listener on Facebook said, called me an attention whore the other day. And I'm like, oh yeah. I'm like, why would I start a podcast? You know? And sometimes those kinds of things can lead to, lead you to do some great things, actually. That's what I think. And so that's why I think that does relate to the show, because it's all about, you know, whether these people's, peculiarities are to be considered as weaknesses or strengths, powers or mental illness.
Yeah. Good take.
Bring it around. All right. So that was actually my number three, too. So, Jim, what's yours?
Oh, boy. My number three?
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to break the format again. I'm going to stick with my number one because we kind of already talked about it, sort of getting bearings in this episode. But I did want to bring up my biggest question of this episode, which is Carrie in the diving suit, the old Carrie. He's kind of either leading people out of the illusion, or perhaps he is actually the demon with yellow eyes. I'm not certain. What is it about Carrie that would make him the one to kind of lead people out to the real world again? Because we see him do that presumably for Melanie, unless you want to say that the person in the diving suit is not always Carrie.
Yes.
And it just happens to be Carrie for Sid, but I don't really know why that would be the case.
I think that,
and that maybe it was Oliver for Melanie.
Yeah. My take on this is that Oliver reached out to Carrie.
Yeah.
And he might have done that because they're both kind of scientists, or for whatever reason, because I think that the deep sea diving suit is analogous to some form of emotional or mental armor that allows them to go out into the astral plane with some kind of protection from parasites, you know? Yeah. So I think that this is what I think we're going to appreciate is Oliver recruited Carrie and taught him some rudimentary, or maybe, like, you know, that's the thing about comic book rules, is maybe the, like, he can actually just wear the suit and that protects him. Like it's okay. Literally something Oliver is extending with his mental powers honed of 20 years living in this environment.
Right.
But then I don't know why Oliver himself didn't go. Maybe Oliver is in particular risk of being contaminated, or, you know, fact that he's been here for 20 years makes it harder for him to make such contact. Yeah.
Or there was just a juicy groove on his radio. Right. He had to get down to.
Right. He had some beat poetry to compose.
Yeah, you definitely get the feeling that he's isolated, and I also wonder if, you know, maybe if they could have gotten Jemaine Clement for one extra episode, then it would have been him in the suit. You know,
that's interesting too.
A budgetary consideration.
Yeah, you can't ever write, because, and it could be that, like, as often some of these budgetary limitations end up being fruitful from a story point, because, like, you put constraints upon the process, and then people are forced to be creative, and, you know, what they end up with is even more interesting. Because I think one of the side effects of him being recruited is it deprives the, who we usually think of as the more tougher Carrie, it deprives her of her brother and shows her as being this kind of vulnerable person who's being preyed on by the Eye, whereas if she had her brother in the next room, would any of that have happened? So, like, if it is, in fact, that you couldn't get Jermaine Clement because he's off recording Manoa or whatever, that might have been nice, because they're right. Like, oh, yeah, that can allow us to see what happens. Mm-hmm. You know, the other Carrie all the time is alone, and, you know, she just pops out into boring parts. Well, now she's the one that's stuck facing the world with, you know, her other half unavailable.
What's Noah?
Oh, Manoa. Moana. I'm sorry.
Oh, Jesus. Moana. Oh, got it.
That's my dyslexic can't pronounce syllables thing correctly. You got the attention whore. I can't say words right. Can't say words good.
Yeah. Damn it.
You know, he played the giant hermit crab in Moana. If you've seen it, yeah.
He's usually good. Did you see What We Do in the Shadows?
I did not.
That's a good one. He's a vampire. Okay, I think it's your turn, Aaron. Number two.
Is it? Okay, well, the other big highlight was the something else we talked about in the intro, the Lenny dance.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Which,
number two. So.
Okay, yeah, I thought, because this felt more peaky. This felt more cohesive and, like, you know, big moments. And I was wondering about us talking over each other, but... and I think that Noah Hawley was just biting hard on, like, the James Bond type of introductions here, but it felt right. This, again, in exactly the same way that David felt when he's doing the, you know, flamingo dancing through, like, all these soldiers, like this malevolent force that's just prancing through people's minds and imaginations, and just, you know, it must be, you think about a parasite and she's been confined to this one host. Mm-hmm. And for whatever weird time dilation, crazy astral thing that's happening in the infinitesimal moment from this guy hosing him down for bullets and impact, she's able to connect with all these minds. And you just really got the feeling of, like, what a thrill that is, that now she's got all these other psyches she can feed upon and maybe gain strength from. And I just thought it was crazy. It was scary. It was intimidating. It was sexy. It was, like, all these things all rolled up into one.
Right. And it's a testament to Aubrey Plaza too, how well she did with that.
Yeah. She's been really good these past couple episodes.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really cool. Good stuff. All right. I guess it's my turn. So my number two is Love and Power. David says that he and Sydney are in love, and Lenny doesn't like that. And she has this great quote. Do you know what love is? A chemical, electrons in your brain sending signals. Are you familiar with Ophiocordyceps unilateralis? It's a fungus that infects ants. It's amazing, really. The spores take over the central nervous system, force them up to climb to a high point, and then the fungus begins to grow up, bursting from the tops of their heads like a branch, and it kills them, of course. Also, it can spray new spores all over the jungle, infecting more ants. When people say love, that's what I think of. So that's a really great image, which I actually showed, and I thought it was cool to see. I think it was really cool that they showed it. And he even looked over as if he was looking at it a couple of times while she was describing it. But then later she calls herself herself your very own walking, talking fungus. So it's like she's equating love with her own parasitic nature, which I thought was kind of interesting. It also, that parasitic description reminds me of how you guys have talked about the Carrie relationship a little bit in the past.
I was going to make that connection there too. Yeah.
Yeah. And it can be, it's like unhealthy love, codependency, enmeshment, things like that. But the interesting thing is that she also sort of has a negative description of love. She says, what's the point of love, life, babies, all of you running around trying to be happy? What fulfilled? The only thing that matters is God, because power, that's the point. Power is the point. Walter understands. So I was a little confused about whether to her love is power and she sees herself in this struggle with Sid to dominate David, or if she thinks that Sid and David's love is a different kind of love. But either way, I think she feels thwarted by Sid and David's love. And she said, I was just going to poison you and move on, but then thought that with our powers together, we could give God a run for his money. But then all this love bullshit, I'm beginning to think I have to go it alone. And I was like, well, how did love thwart that? And then I was watching on second time and she's saying, I've tried to keep you comfortable. I let you have your friends, but it's too much work. So basically, I think Sid being the skeptical one of everybody and kind of keeping on questioning the nature of this reality is key, because Lenny's just getting tired of that. Doesn't want to have to deal with it. She's separated Sid from David at least once when Sid started poisoning David's mind with that. And so she just ends up hypnotizing her and locking her away. And then when David comes in and saying, I can't find Sid, where is she? That's when, Lenny finally just goes, okay, fuck it. I'm just going to put you in a coffin and take your body and not try to orchestrate this whole scam to placate you anymore. So I kind of think that's what was going on.
Yeah, it's interesting, because if I heard a real person talk like Lenny did, I would think, my God, who hurt you? Mm-hmm. Like, that's the thing. I don't quite get the nature of Lenny yet. Like, is she literally a demon? Like some kind of thing that evolved in the astral plane as a true parasite? Was there any aspect of her that was ever human? And like, why has she come up with all these like toxic metaphors for love and happiness? It makes, I think, a more interesting dynamic to portray the big villain as a walking wound itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it feels like something you'd hear Agent Smith say in the first Matrix.
Yeah. Which, by the way, like, if you are fascinated by this cordyceps, this parasitic fungus description, I got a book recommendation.
Go with all the gifts. No.
No, it's Parasite Rex by Carl Zimmer, who is a research scientist. And he does a really good job of, like, each chapter is a different type of horrific parasite that... And it's not just like, you know, the tapeworms of the world, which are definitely in there. But like, he really does deep dives into these things, like you know, the things that get in the brain and compel the ant to climb to the highest stalk it can so it can spread the spores, or the barnacle that remaps a crab to turn it into a female and mind control it, or the... the parasite that gets inside of a fish brain and makes it hover near the surface so an eagle can eat it, and then it completes its life cycle in the eagle's guts that then shit the bones out in the water that started over. And it's just like this really insane, crazy World War III going on all around us. And there's also some kind of unsettling things about, you know, research showing like that humans could be susceptible to some of these very same things. You know, that's more speculative, but it's also kind of creepy to think that, like, you know, us being outgoing or risk taking, or, you know, what are the what behaviors that we exhibit that might be negative or the influence of some kind of alien biology.
You just got to eat more yogurt, Aaron.
Yeah.
It'll take care of all your biomes.
Yeah, yeah. They say all the
drooling wreck
bacteria in your gut are incredibly influential towards your state of mind and your mood and everything.
Right.
But it has, that stuff has made its way into speculative fiction, because that book that I just blurted out, The Girl with All the Gifts, is my favorite zombie book ever. And I met the author in London. I brought him to Walker Stalker. It was so great. But anyway, he uses that, the Ophiocordyceps infects humans, and that's how and they even have the stalks growing out of their heads at one point.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, infamously, that's also The Last of Us.
Yeah. Right. Have you guys played that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So great.
Got to watch out for the clickers.
Okay. where are we now? Aaron.
I thought the one that I also really enjoyed is the scene where David's sister comes, and I'm not sure if it's actually his sister. I could believe it either way, but she says, and we were talking about last week about how, you know, I was kind of uncomfortable with some of this psychology about people that adopt and are adopted, but I thought that it paid off kind of nicely when she came up with this, like, every time, you know, we look at you, we just want to vomit. You're just so disgusting. And,
yeah.
And, like, this, then she started physically retching, which made David retch, which kind of was a little comical, but I also thought that's, like, preying on David's, like, deep-seated fear, right? Like, that's got to be the thing that adopted kids, like, that's got to be their worst nightmare, the fact that, like, any love or affection they're experiencing could potentially be fake. And, you know, like, to the extent that anyone's vulnerable to the, like, you know, nobody likes you. And if any friends you think are just you know, laughing behind your back. And, you know, that's a very kind of a paranoid look. But I thought it was really effective. And then when it led to the actual retching, I thought it was pretty affecting. And it just really made me feel very, very badly for David and the situation he's in, a situation he's been in his entire life.
Yeah. For me, I loved all that too, but there's something about the way Dan Stevens is playing this, and I think he's really good, but I still don't feel as emotionally connected to his plight as I would like. Like, there was another, I can't remember what it was, but there was another moment in this episode where it was, I could, you know, I felt like I should be being more moved than I was, but it's like there's a blankness behind his performance. Do you know what I mean?
Huh. There's certainly times where I don't feel his performance, but I think some of that's intentional. Like,
yeah,
the one that I was having a trouble with was him and Ptolemy when they are conspiratorially discussing this guy who's drooling in front of him, and Ptolemy's just like all in, like, you know, whereas I feel like David was like, his mind was elsewhere, and then he sees what's going on, and then he's like affecting the same kind of like slightly mean-spirited poking fun at this person.
But it feels like an affectation, yeah.
But I think that's kind of like we were supposed to think that, like, you know, David was a lot kind of lost in his thoughts and otherwise, and like Ptolemy's kind of ripping his mind off or whatever he's thinking about. But I think in this scene, he did a really good job of portraying a 35-ish year old man who is suddenly affecting a 6-year old boy's perspective and fears. And that I could see how that could come across as artificial or not good. I don't have the right or affected, as you said. But I thought it was, you know, like, again, I think I said this last week, like, how the hell is that supposed to look like? How is it, like, you know, a 30-year-old reverting back to being a 6-year-old scared little boy?
Yeah.
What does that look like?
It's got to be hard to play these parts. Lenny, too. I mean, she's
right.
Just, it's so complicated what they're trying to call. The other instance of that is when he was talking to her and she was playing the psychologist, and he said, you know, I feel like everything's balanced right now and I just don't want to mess everything up. And I just wish I had felt that a little bit more. I don't know why. But the sister I thought was really great. It must have been fun to play kind of this sassy Nurse Ratched act.
Right.
I was wondering, yeah, why she was being so sadistic. And everybody else is an aspect of their real personality transported to this reality. So if you think about it that way, and she is too, then she must have some kind of maybe repressed feelings like that. I mean, I don't know. The other thing is maybe she's, you know, somehow Lenny's just manipulating her to prey on David. But I think it's more interesting to think that she actually has some of those feelings in real life.
I mean, I wonder how much each person in this illusion is themselves, essentially. Because my number three here is that scene between David and Sid where David doesn't even recognize his own neuroses and his own mental issues, let alone Sid's. Like, I think in that moment that's the demon represented as David, but I'm not certain about that. What do you guys think?
Well, yeah, because to answer what Jason was talking about with the sister and not being sure if that is like her real aspect, it's like, it's interesting because like, I think everyone can relate to the fact that when you're at your angriest or your loneliness or you're most frustrated, the way you think of the people around you is not an accurate way. And like, if those thoughts got out into the world about like, you know, how you felt about people in that moment when you're not being your best self, like some people just let it out. Like if you're drunk or you're high or you've got poor self-control, that just like, you see those like toxic people, they spew that shit. I mean, I don't know. Maybe this isn't true. I feel like that shit is inside everyone. It's just that, you know, if you have sufficient control and you've got your base needs to, you can have enough control to like not let that stuff out, but it's still there,
right?
Like growing
any
up,
any person who is having a really shitty month, for example, and they're just not their best selves, then the different
because nobody's perfect and none of us are angels, so everyone does shit that's imperfect and gets on people's nerves. And like I don't absolutely believe that this girl who grew up with this boy who's so bizarre and so strange and has so many special needs never once resented him and never once felt like, God, you know, why can't he just be normal? And if those thoughts were allowed, you know, that essentially that subconscious thoughts were allowed to bubble out, it might look like that. Now, that's something she would never, ever say.
Right.
Because she's also rational enough to know, like, that's not his fault and I still love him. And
exactly. She can simultaneously have those aspects of revulsion and love.
And that's what's so fun is when you're playing on the mental battlefield, there are no of those distinctions. And it's just like all that raw connection all the time. And I think that's some of the thing that Lenny is playing with here.
Is it wrong that I really enjoyed the scene where she slapped her hands on Sid's ass?
Yeah, I don't know. It's so funny because like I was thinking that from Sid's perspective as someone who doesn't like being touched. And here's a person who is, you know,
violating her.
Violating, like, and that's the thing, like, not even doing the bare necessity of trying to do whatever she's trying to do to be safe, but like I thought she was kind of over the line with just how she was feeling her up, and then absolutely, you know, obviously to slap on the end, there was nothing about safety there. That was just exerting power over someone that doesn't have any.
It just felt like it was a little bit played for comedy, but that could just be me. I don't know. Anyway,
you're a bad person.
I'm a bad person. All right.
And an attention whore.
Oh, man. We're psychoanalyzing me this time. All right.
What were you? So, but that was the thing about I want to say about his sister. What question?
I was basically saying in this scene between David and Sid, David doesn't seem to be himself.
Right.
And I think that's because that's not actually David in that moment. I think that's the demon with yellow eyes. And I'm wondering if not truly understanding either David or Sid or their relationship even exactly could be the demon's weakness here in this illusion.
It could be.
And the crack that Sid kind of uses to get out of it.
Right. And she's the one that does see those cracks, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, the gross little boil on the wall or the weird door, which is that David's bedroom? Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what she eventually floats through at the end, I think.
I think it's David. I just think that he's under the illusion for whatever reason, because there's another point in the episode where he talks about his manic depressiveness too. So he thinks he's manic depressive. And so I don't see why he wouldn't also then have a misconception about her problem too.
So where did he get that idea from? Did he get it from his previous therapist? Like a misdiagnosis or something? Like what is...
I think it's from
or
Lenny.
Is that from Lenny from the demon?
I'm open to like David literally being the demon in some of these scenes, or, you know, his sister literally being the demon. If that's the case, I wish they had done something to let us know that that was going on. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, the fact that whoever the telekinetic or the psychokinetic guy is, he's portrayed as a drooling, mindless person because he literally has had his mind taken over by the eye. Mm-hmm. I wish there was something like their eyes had flashed yellow or something to suggest that, because like that's not a distinction without a difference, right? Like if David's just confused and he's under the influence, that's different than if literally, you know, Lenny is manifesting as David's body when she's talking to Sid, and you know that's a huge difference in how you interpret or see the scene.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, I interpreted it that he's invested in this reality because, as he said to Sid, I feel grounded here, and, you know, he likes it. And for whatever reason, I'm like, she's pathologizing all of them, and for whatever reason, she's labeled him as a manic depressive, and
right.
She had labeled Sid as delusional, so I think everybody in this scenario is operating under that, except for Sid, who's kind of breaking free of it.
So I guess the elephant in the room here, the elephant in the psychic room, is what the hell is going on here? This all started when Sid threw herself in front of David and said, white room, right?
Right.
Implying that there is some volition of David's in here.
Mm-hmm.
And is that are those the cracks in the wall in David's little room? And also, like, we speculated that that Sid or David might die because flashing to this room is not going to stop the bullets. And yet, they were very careful to show us that we were mistaken, that for whatever confluence of their powers, the days that they're spending inside this world are milliseconds on the outside.
Mm-hmm.
So does anyone have any ideas about what the hell is going on here?
I don't know, but I assumed that in that flash of a moment, for whatever reason, David pulled everybody's psyche into this other realm, and somehow the demon got control of it. That's it.
Because everybody in that room got sucked in. I mean, yeah. I guess that's David's doing, and then the parasites are running rampant through it all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Seems like it. I mean, I think that's him trying to save Sid. Because in that moment, she's going to die, most likely. She gets hit by all those bullets. So he's trying to do something to prevent it. And, you know, now he's stuck in kind of in this moment with the demon. And now they have to do battle on kind of both planes here.
Yeah, I don't know how they're going to save Sid. Like, they might come up with something, but also I think
David needs to take control, you know, because David has the power to save her. Like, clearly he
does. Does he?
It seems to me, yes.
Or is that the, like, because all the flashy stuff he does when he's, like, in full combat mode, I feel like those are the demon powers.
Right, but if he can harness the abilities that he has of telekinesis and such, he can certainly stop those bullets. I mean, he has stopped those bullets.
That's why the demon's interested in him, because he's a powerful.
He has a powerful body, yeah.
Right. But she herself is also powerful, and I don't know where I don't know where his powers begin and hers end, and vice versa.
Yeah.
Like, are they just both? Is she a telekinetic telepath? And so is he. And they're just like two waves hit together. They're amplified. Or is he a powerful telepath and she's a powerful telekinetic?
Mm-hmm.
And that's how they share the powers. That's still unclear to me.
Right.
I know how he could save them both. He could just teleport them. The way he's done many times before.
True.
Teleport those bullets in front of somebody else.
Yeah, in front of the eye. Shoot out his eyes.
His other eye. All right, my turn. So, number one. We've kind of talked around this, but how these people's behaviors and personalities manifest themselves in this skewed reality where they're all patients in this psych clinic. Melanie, Dr. Lenny says to her, you still have his voice on your answering machine. And that's not exactly right. It's a coffee machine, and she has this body in a cryo chamber. But I thought it was interesting. There's like a slight parallel with how they are here and how they are. And my favorite was Carrie and Carrie, how well they work together in the therapy room. They get a therapy session together. I don't know. Would they have them have a therapy session together? You'd think they'd have several ones, but they're finishing each other's sentences. And even their body movements kind of flow one to the other. And it made me wonder about the relationship between the actors for one thing, because it feels like a girl like that and a guy like that would be pretty different. So this role would force them to figure out ways to connect. I could be wrong, but it'd be interesting to see the process.
It's probably a point of humor for them too. I could see, you know, the director just in there saying, no, get closer. Like, really? You want us to jam our arm? Okay.
Yeah. All right. I actually did like that touch to where they, in every scene, they are physically not separated.
Right. Except, like the ping pong, you know, every time we're at Clockworks, we hear ping pong going on. And when these two are playing it, they never miss a shot because they're so in sync. The ball never falls off the table.
Was I crazy, or the first time we saw them playing ping pong, there was actually no ball?
I didn't notice that.
I thought, like, and I went to rewind it, because when I noticed that, it was kind of already passed. But I swear to God, the first time they were going through the motions of playing ping pong, but there wasn't actually a ball there. But don't quote me on that. That could be just my parasite talking.
But they're cute. Like, he pulls out the rainbow scarf, which is really sweet, and they do a Wonder Twins fist bump at one point, and so I enjoyed watching all that. Now, Patonomy with his silly putty to copy images from the newspaper, that seems related to his eidetic memory and just knowing every detail of the day his mom died. I wasn't sure actually what happened to his mom, though. We didn't really get that, right?
It seemed like she had like a massive stroke or like an aneurysm. Yeah, something that just kills you. Like, something that can happen to a young person would kill you quick. Because she wasn't that like mid-30s, like, you know, as old as you'd expect a woman with a child Ptolemy's age to be.
Right. And I thought,
like, how fucked would that be?
Yeah.
Not great.
Especially if you have that gift or whatever, you know, where
curse in this case. Yeah.
But it was interesting. So when he was they were talking about the guy with the spittle coming out of his mouth. I'm pretty sure that's a direct reciting of Lenny's dialogue from the pilot. They're sitting there. Lenny was sitting there with, right?
Yeah. Right.
So I wonder if he's like subconsciously picking up on David's memories and reciting them or something.
That would make sense.
Because of his power. And then the eye in this world is still a predator, and
his mutant powers are to make women uncomfortable and creeped out from any arbitrary distance. He's just got a gift.
Yeah, I just wanted to see Carrie kick his ass.
I know. What? That was the thing about her. None of her fightingness came through. Why not? That was interesting.
Right.
Because she didn't have the support of the other Carrie, you know?
Well, I mean, I guess because she said, "I bite," but she was unsure of herself. And that scene, Carrie had already left. He had already gone to the ice cube plane or whatever. So maybe she can't be strong and without the connection she has to her twin.
Mm. But it was actually kind of fun and revelatory to see her not just be a one-note character talking about fighting all the time.
Sure.
But I also don't understand what about her fascinated. Like, what's the eye's deal, man? Like, why is he singling out this Carrie among everyone else?
Mm-hmm. Because she's a young, pretty girl, maybe.
I mean, that's the thing. Like, is it just a truly purient, you know, interest that he has in her, or is there something left over in, because even then, like, they didn't even really fight, you know? She got beat down by a bunch of the black spandex bulletproof vest covered goons. It wasn't the eye himself doing it,
right?
So
we really
don't
know anything about him, except that apparently he was at Summerland, but he liked to hurt
people.
His
name is Walter. Yep.
We don't know. I wonder if he'll make it to season two.
I don't know.
That's it for my number one. I have some random notes. What about you guys?
I think I've talked about most of the stuff I had.
We talked about everything except for what I guess, like I said, I still haven't got a clear idea of like what exactly is going on and what's the implication of like when Oliver or I guess Carrie took Melanie out into the real world and she tried to move the bullets and she couldn't, and she tried to move
David and Sid
and she couldn't. Mm-hmm. Is that just to kind of show us the stakes, because it's not going to be some kind of simple solution
you
know, Quicksilver X-Men movie type of deal. Mm-hmm.
Maybe it was at least in part just to show us that time was slowed way down and this was still happening.
Yeah, are we talking about time powers here? Because I think like the spinning of the bullet seems to indicate that time's just moving very slowly.
Yeah, definitely.
As opposed
is still
to
advancing.
The telekinesis.
Right.
Just kind of stopping everything. But telekinesis is also involved, right? Because David is stuck in place, the bullets are stuck in place, potentially.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, what we know from that is they're still in danger of being shot, but they have some time, but not infinite time, to figure it out. We learn that David's father gave him away to try and hide him from this parasite, and it didn't work. That was interesting.
Yeah, we had a lot of talk about David's father, a lot of mysterious talk about David's father.
Right.
And not only did it not work, it failed spectacularly. Like, she's talking about from the womb.
It seems almost like it'd be the worst thing to do if...
Yeah, like, that almost makes me, like, it's like, that's the worst possible outcome. Like, there was not, it's not like, you know, Star Wars, where Darth Vader happened to have an investigation on an unrelated investigation on Tatooine 16, 17 years later. Like, literally, oh, you tried to melt? No, there's the zygote. Just homing in on it. What the hell?
Right.
But I guess maybe if it took, you know, maybe if he's like a 7-month-old fetus in there, like that's an eternity in the astral plane, because we see how long you can get just in the space of a gunshot, you know?
I mean, it makes me wonder, okay, so if she's been a parasite since he was born and he's 30 or whatever he is, what has she been doing this whole time? Has she had a grand plan, or is she just been kind of fucking around, you know?
What is the long-term plan here?
Mm-hmm. I mean, it seems like she's just decided, okay, I'm going to take over your body and wreak havoc in the real world. But why did it take this long?
She's also done it before, because she says, you know, usually I would just get you and discard you. But and dispose.
Power.
Yeah, but it's weird, like, why in previous, like, when does she, how often does she jump, how often does Lenny typically jump bodies? Mm-hmm. How long does she stay in them? Is there a limit? Like, because there's also in previous episode talking about, like, this is a particular powerful parasite that would need a particular powerful mind to manifest itself into, right? So, like, a normal person might not even work at all. I'm just kind of like, you know, trying to piece together what we know about the nature of this parasite and, you know, how old we think it is and how many times it's done this. And if that gives us any clues to like what its actual ambitions are.
It looks like, I feel like there's two more episodes. Is that right? This number six.
Yep.
Yeah. I'm guessing that this parasite story is going to be resolved by the end of the season. I think it's going to be destroyed.
Huh.
And then, I mean, we kind of speculated about that an episode or two ago, and, you know, what a season two without the parasite idea might look like. Is it going to be more straightforward?
Well, now that we know David has had this thing with him for his whole life, then that makes it a little more interesting to me to say, okay, what's he going to be like without it? And
right.
Yeah, and it's not going to be, it would be really boring if he was like, oh, I'm normal now.
Yeah,
that's what I think.
He'll still have some healing to do, for sure.
I have a hard time thinking they're going to kill off the parasite. Now, parasite might be beaten to come back later on in the series as a even more existential threat, but...
Yeah, I could see that too, yeah, absolutely. Okay, cool. That's it. Let's get into listener feedback. This is food for thought, and also just kind of take the temperature of what you guys thought about the episode. I'll go first. Dylan Blank says, really enjoying the show. I don't know how this episode progressed the plot much, but I did enjoy it still. Aubrey Plaza is such a great actor. She looks and acts so crazy, and Dan Stevens as well. He makes the best faces. He does.
He does. He makes pretty good faces. I especially like his faces when he is surprised or kind of confounded by something.
Mm-hmm.
I think those are some pretty good Dan Stevens faces.
And I like how he's a little twitchy sometimes and he doesn't want to look you directly in the eye.
Mm-hmm.
It's good.
Andy Crompton of Manchester, the United Kingdom, says, wondering what you thought of the use of color in Legion so far. Oh boy, my favorite topic. I can't stop seeing this deep pink color everywhere. It's all over Division 3, from the colors of the doors and the tables to the grunts' woolly hats. If this is the color of Division 3, I'd explain the color of the spiral stripes on the lighthouse on Episode 4. Furthermore, Carrie's brain scans of David show a deep pink color area. Is this where Division 3 has invaded David's unconsciousness? Another interesting point is that Sid often wears flashes of this pink, whether it's from the bows in her hair or to a pink shirt. Is she actually working for Division 3? The show's credits end with graphics of simple pink and green. Is this a coincidence? Perhaps the green is an indicative color to some, or to come. Finally, David's t-shirts in Episode 5 was very interesting. A yellow triangle, the color of the demon's eyes. Was this to represent how the parasite had taken him over?
Hmm.
You know, this goes back from our very first coverage of Breaking Bad, where people got, in my opinion, way too far into the color spectrum theory, and it continued to confound me in Mad Men analysis. I feel like a theory with zero predictive power is no theory at all, and I feel like that's a lot of this color. Like, I feel like there's certainly thematic things and like visual. Like when you look at a character and how they're dressed, the director wants you to feel something, but that's not in itself, you know, it's something that only reinforces what they're already doing. It's not its own little band of information that has secret.
It's a complimentary thing, just like the soundtrack, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Like I don't think, like, if someone wrote in and said, if you played the Legion episode backwards, you actually find out that, you know, Lenny is this or that, I'd be like, huh, okay, that's interesting. And I feel like that's a little bit of how this color stuff comes across. And I'm not picking on you, Andy, because you're in very good company, and I'm particularly on the other end of the spectrum from this, but I just, you know, it's certainly interesting, and I think it's cool in a visual sense, but I don't think it has any kind of, like, real predictive power over, like, you know, what comes next, or like, oh, this was purple and now it's pink. What does this mean? What do you guys think?
Like, in Breaking Bad, Walter White's color palette got darker as his character got darker, right? You could say that, right?
But that's it wasn't like that's like oh my god, look at Walter, he's coming in purple now. Oh geez, I bet he's going to be evil. I mean, it was always like lockstep, right?
Or he's got his red shirt on, someone's going to die this episode.
Or it's a countdown. He went from purple to red. Next episode he's going to be in maroon and shit's going to be real, yo. Like, That's a theory. Right, if you could demonstrate that, then that would actually have me sit up and take notice.
I think.
Yeah, it's.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
It's more of a thematic reflection of the kind of the feelings of the character, and especially in Breaking Bad.
And also, just this show, it looks like, you know, the visuals are important and they want it all to fit together. But now here's, I went back to this interview with Legion costume designer Carol Case, and this, I think, totally backs up what you guys are saying. But she says, you'll notice that the color of the stripes on the character's jackets and pants varies. Those serve as indicators of how serious each patient's case is. Oh, this is actually a little different. Hmm. Sydney Barrett has white stripes, which puts her in the least crazy category. David's are yellow, which means he's a moderate case, and Lenny has red, which basically means she's never getting out of there. But then she adds that early on she assigned each primary character a signature color from within that palette. Jean Smart is always in soft beigey neutral colors, and Sid always in black and orange. So there's different reasons that people can choose colors.
But that's a perfect example. This woman is not writing the show. She is taking the scripts and what the director and the writers are doing, and then she's reinforcing that thing. So, you know, she's not coloring outside the lines and be like, I want to let you in on this little secret. I think that the Noah Hawleys of the world would frown off on that kind of stuff. So, it's certainly supportive. And that's what costume and makeup does. Yeah. You know, we're going to tell you that I is creepy and violent and predatory, and we're going to give him this creepy milky eye, and we're going to cast this gaunt dude with crazy ass hair, and we're going to do all this stuff to reinforce that. And it's also interesting because sometimes they do it against type, right? Like Aubrey Plaza's perfect example. Like they cast this kind of quirky, conventionally attractive woman to play the most evil character in the show because it disarms you. You're not prepared for it.
Yeah.
So like, you know, it's always type and anti-type with these people.
Right.
Jim? All right, let's move on to Abby. She says, "Hi, my name is Abby and I have a theory. My theory answers the question of why people dress and have some outdated technology from the 70s and 80s, but still have futuristic technology like flat screens. My theory is it takes place in the future, so they have access to advanced technology, but that they are in a throwback phase to the 70s and 80s, where people dress from that time and use retro technology. My dad has a theory as well. He thinks, excuse me, he thinks that the reason why Sydney can see stuff in David's mind while others can't is because Sydney and David are in a state of psionic rapport. Do you know what that means?"
It means they're... It sounds...
I feel like this is the name of a song from the 70s that I should know.
I mean, rapport just means you have a good, right. Good so this simpatico is like a relationship.
Superhuman, right? Version of that.
Okay.
That's what it sounds like. I think it's just a stylistic thing. We've talked about it before, that they want the show to seem timeless and also to sort of not be... have us feel too grounded in any one reality. And so they mix and match... styles.
And there's certainly hints, like when Ptolemy said that his mom was singing Red 99 Red Balloons, Luft Balloons. That is kind of like, to me, shows us that this is kind of modern day. Because if you take a 6-year-old Ptolemy and fast forward 20 or so years and look at the charts, then like that stuff kind of all lines up. But again, is it important to understanding the show to know what... I mean, I guess it is, because if this is part of the larger MCU, you're trying to see how this is going to fit in with Patrick Stewart and the other fucking guy. You want to see... Because, you know, a lot of that stuff was very 70s and early 80s kind of tech. So, like, I guess maybe that's why the fans are really concerned with the time frame, because they want to see where those are connecting. Mm-hmm. But well, I think, more to your point, not only is a stylistic thing to look timeless, but also maybe to kind of confound that a little bit.
Yeah, exactly.
And leave their options open.
I mean, I think another thing is people see that, okay, the styles look retro, but there's advanced technology. And this theory that Abby just had explains that. But I also, if you're a comic book reader, a lot of stories set in the modern day have technology that does not exist. Spaceships and computers and holograms and all kinds of stuff. It's kind of a comic book convention. So I think that might be part of it too.
It's all the Shi'ar technology crossover. Yeah. But yeah, that's a good point, because like you got characters like, you know, Superman and Batman who are 70, 80 plus years old, but they're always 35.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and sometimes they lean in, like Captain America. He's a super soldier and he spent a bunch of time in an iceberg. So yeah, he was in the prime of his life fighting Hitler, and he's in the prime of his life now. But and Wolverine's got the anti-aging serum. But Batman, he's just eternally an angry 35-year-old dude at his physical maturity peak.
Iron Man will always be that way. Was originally in Vietnam, but I think he turned to the Gulf War after a while.
Right, exactly. Same thing, same deal with the Punisher. You know, he was originally a Vietnam era vet, and you know that becomes untenable after a while. So it's all timey-wimey. The Doctor Who mumbo jumbo when it comes to comic books.
Just wave your hand and enjoy it. Okay. Rick says, "Sloppy writing. Sid stated, while inside me, I switched back to my own form from my mom's and all hell broke loose. If true, with her powers back, wouldn't she have by default swapped bodies with him due to the constant physical contact?"
Oh shit. They'd be swapping back and forth forever.
No, I think she would have had to be having sex with her mom for that to happen. Right? Right? I mean, that's how it works. She gets the powers of whoever she swaps into, which in this case would be nobody, no powers because it's her mom who doesn't have any powers.
But she's reverted back to her own body. So her and her mom physically switched bodies. Now her stepdad's actually in her body.
Okay.
So that's touching.
And then they would have
Then they would have swept and her. Suddenly stepdad had been fucking himself.
Shit.
I think there's a refractory period to this.
You think so?
Yeah. Sure.
It's like when you lose a life in Mario or something and you come back and you're flashing.
Right, right. Yeah, you're in vulnerability frames.
Yeah.
Yeah. You got just enough time to separate and figure out what's going on. Angie G, she's taking it to me here, guys. Every time I search a podcast, there are 10 minutes of complaining about having to do this podcast, and it then continues later. Either do the podcast or don't. I'm sorry to be so blunt. I keep trying to listen, but especially number 5 began with a comment about being forced to do this podcast. Really? So when I say things about how unfortunate it is to be forced to do a podcast about a certain show, the last thing I want people to think is that I'm complaining about my life as a podcaster. What I'm trying to say is you don't go to a movie and like five or 10 minutes in, pause it and stand up in front of theater and be like, I don't know, guys, these characters are all very thinly written and I'm not sure their motivations. Hell, I don't even know what's going on. This is a mess. Or if you're reading chapter 1 of the book, like, oh, who are all these assholes and what?
Why should I care?
Why should I care? I mean, it's like there's a complicit thing that you're going to give the author a little bit of rope to tell their story. So, but with television criticism, you throw all that out in the window because, you know, the internet age, everybody, you know, the water cooler being what it is, some shows lend that, you know, they're structured to where they reward that kind of stuff. And some shows feel more like you are complaining about the first 5 minutes of the movie or first chapter. So one of the most valuable things I think a critic can do is illuminate to the audience how they approach a work. So, like, and that's one of the things I always appreciate about Roger Ebert. Like, whether he loved or hated a movie, I knew enough about his approach that I could then adjust that for how I felt about those same things. And then, like, oh, he didn't like that, but I'll probably like it because Ebert's known to be, you know, very not tolerant of XYZ, and I don't care about that stuff. So, when I'm saying that, I just want you to know that, like, I'm about to bitch about things. That's entirely likely that's an intentional, and these are things that you're supposed to be noticing or complaining or not sure about. And if I wasn't not podcasting, I'd just be like, oh, well, next one. But since I have to, I'm forced to come up with an opinion, it might not be to everyone's taste. And
that's the thing with some shows, you can, you know, maybe they do that once in a while where there's not a lot to talk about because there's not a lot to go on, right? And some shows, like if they mix and match those sort of things, it can be very fun 1 week to talk about it, and the next week it can be almost impossible.
Right.
So I think that's, you know, I think I was part of that discussion as well, and that's kind of what I meant is, you know, week to week, maybe there's not quite as much to talk about.
Right. You know, you know, ultimately it's my way of trying to apologize for perhaps being dismissive or overly critical, because, you know, there's some shows and movies that you watch and it's like, well, this is just failing. It's just they intended to do this and they're not doing it and it sucks. And there's some, like, you know, David Lynch movies especially, where you're just, you know, supposed to feel that way, and then it's how do you feel at the end of the movie. And you know, I just, like, I'm trying to, I guess, blunt that or let people know what I'm talking about. And I do feel like sometimes it comes across, if you're going to be inclined to not, like, if you're really digging and this episode of Legion blew your mind and Aaron comes and says, oh, this feels like, you know, an unfinished chapter of a book, you're already going to be pissed. And then when he's trying to explain this view, and it sounds like he's complaining about having to do the podcast, like, I can understand why that would make a person crazy. But it's not what I'm trying to do, and I apologize if I came off like that.
At this point, we're 6 episodes in. Do you have a feel for whether at the end of this you're going to look back and go, oh, that was a pretty good show, or not?
I think
the answer is yes on that for me.
This last episode, I think, is when, because up in the last 2 episodes previous to this, I was very like, oh man, this is really relying on this single trick of like, is this real or is it not real? And those are the least, like, I made no attempt to hide my distaste for that kind of current flavor of the month storytelling. And now where it's like getting down to the business of telling a story without these tricks, it's an interesting one.
Yeah.
And I think it's a fair point to consider whether maybe this should have been a 6-episode season. So they didn't have to, but you know, the next episode. Yeah. But on the other hand, like I said, you know, like any good book, sometimes this stuff is important and these, seemingly unrelated or extraneous details will come up big in the final two chapters of the book and reveal everything. So who knows? I'm feeling better about it this week than I was the past two.
Cool. Next.
Eric Mahler has some information regarding foreskin restoration. He wants everybody to go to norm.org. He says, good luck. I took a brief scan of it. There are various methods for restoring your foreskin. And this is kind of a group for people who are in the process of or already have restored their foreskin.
Mm-hmm.
There are various pinching and stretching devices. Yeah. There are surgical techniques.
Certainly.
It's an impressive array.
It says... The National Organization of Restoring Men is a nonprofit support group for men who have concerns about being circumcised or considering foreskin restoration or are in the process of restoring their foreskins. Our aim is to help men regain a sense of self-directedness physically as well as emotionally. And I am not 100% sure this is real.
Oh, no, it is.
It's
oh,
very yeah. detailed.
I've gone through that because I've first discovered this. Subculture about 10 years ago.
Whoa.
I can't remember where on the internet, but there are guys who feel very, like betrayed by the fact that, you know, this thing was done to them and they feel like they're missing out and it's not natural and they want to restore that aspect. And, you know, there's all kinds of reasons and there's all kinds of approaches and everything. It's like, you know, like whatever someone wants to do with their junk to make them feel good about themselves, I'm not going to take a real strong stand on. I honestly, I'm kind of like anti-circumcision myself because it does feel like at the least an unnecessarily cosmetic procedure, done for purely cultural reasons. Which I, you know, that I'm never down, but I also think that sometimes the way people like Norm speak of men that have been uncircumcised as like they've been mutilated or, you know, what I don't think that's super helpful. So, right. You know, I'm kind of in the middle.
Yeah. It's in that sort of pathologizing thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, thank you anyway. Appreciate your concern. That's it for the main part of the show. The news this week is just a little spoilery, but we'll put it at the end just in case people don't want to hear anything like that. And then the next week's segment after that has some kind of bigger spoilers. Not anything too momentous, but kind of bigger. So in the meantime, if you want to get in touch with us, you can email us at legion@baldmove.com.
You can also find us on the web at facebook.com/legionpod.
And be sure to check out other shows at baldmove.com and Podcastica. And also, Jason wanted to do some pimping.
That's right. So both those networks are listener supported. And we haven't even mentioned that once, but we will now. So what do you got? What's your guys' thing?
If you would like to support Bald Move, the Bald Move flavor of independent podcasting, you can go to club.baldmove.com, where we have a plethora of incentives and features such as ad-free podcasts, et cetera, et cetera. And premium content to reward people that would choose to support us. Jason?
And we've got patreon.com/JasonandKaren where you can contribute and we have some cool rewards and stuff there too. So let's get into the news. So FX announced, did you guys hear they're renewing Legion for a second season?
Mm-hmm. I did see that.
FX programming president Eric Schreier said the first season of Legion was a stunning achievement, if I do say so myself. More than a new series, Legion is a wholly original take on the superhero genre. Our thanks to Noah Hawley for taking creative risks and shattering expectations. So it airs in 2018, but they didn't say how many episodes or when in the year it will it will air. But I'm sure Noah Hawley likes to do short seasons.
Sure. Were you? I was kind of surprised that they came out this early because the show debuted okay at 1.62, but it's dropped below quite a bit below a million. It's like 0.75, 0.8 in the last two chapters, and I thought that was on the cusp of FX maybe willing. Now I know they've shown forbearance with like the Americans. Because that's, you know, gotten, even though it's had sagging ratings, it continues to be a critical darling and get a lot of rewards or awards for the, and I know they did for Fargo for similar reasons. Although its ratings were a bit stronger. I was actually surprised that to hear that they, I guess not surprised that they renewed it, just surprised that they renewed it mid season without like having some time to think about it, see if it kind of had a second life on Netflix or what kind of buzz it would get or among critics. What are your guys' thoughts about that?
Yeah, I think as we see more of these streaming services online establishing themselves, companies like FX, like you know, AMC, they're trying to create this cachet more and more so that they can kind of attract people to those platforms. Because ultimately, like, if you're on one of those platforms and you're paying for it, it doesn't matter what individual shows are doing. It's kind of an overall thing, right?
Do you think this part of this is also like posturing to it seems like everybody wants their pay network.
Yeah,
like you know,
yeah, that's what I mean.
It, like a year from now, like FX now becomes something you can get for $2 or $3. Mm-hmm. And hey, mm-hmm. you Legion, and if you're a cord cutter, you know, there you go. I wonder if some of this stuff is building those kind of libraries.
The reporting on it on the show talks about it as if it's a rating success too, and it might be that it does really well in a delayed viewing. I don't know how big a factor that is, but it might be.
Yeah.
Okay, next. Aubrey Plaza, Hollywood Reporter interview. They're asking about this scene where she describes the ophiocordyceps and basically confirms she's been hiding out in David's head since he was in the womb. She says, that was probably the most difficult scene of the series for me. Essentially, I'm playing four different characters in one scene, or at least that's how it was in my head. The scene is kind of a big deal. You've seen drug addict Lenny, overalls Lenny appearing as these hallucinations. You've seen Lenny in a suit that's kind of this crazy Beetlejuice character who has some other agendas. You've seen therapist Lenny. So that scene was very complicated for me, and it was really fun and really challenging. It's Lenny's biggest moment in the series.
I believe it.
It's interesting to hear how she thinks about it.
That's the thing. Like, I think this probably is fun for Aubrey Plaza because I've seen quite a bit of Aubrey Plaza, and there's a particular spectrum that you get. Like when I think of her and like Scott Pilgrim and Community and even Bad Grandpa and whatever that Dick Face and Butthole Need a Date to Hawaii movie.
Parks and Rec too.
Did I say? Oh, I meant to say Parks. I said Community instead. There's a certain kind of like type of character she plays, and this was a little bit of a lot of, you know, it started off with that core character, but since then I think she's gotten to do things that she's never really gotten to do in anything else. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I like that. Well, like it must be fun for her to come in and be kind of asked to stretch like that.
Absolutely. Jean Smart, who plays Melanie, told Digital Spy that she and her castmates weren't always 100% sure what was going on the show. She said, we would sort of compare notes. Did you read the new script? Did you get it? Did you understand? And we just decided to give ourselves over to that, let it carry us along like a roller coaster. The thing is, even if you don't completely understand it, you know that it comes from an absolutely crystal clear vision on Noah Hawley's part. You know that it's all going to come together in some fantastic way, so you're willing to just go with it and trust. That'd be tough, man. I always thought that about Lost. You know, none of them knew what the hell was going on for the whole
series.
Even
the showrunners.
Yeah, even by the time it ended, no one knew. Anyway. Noah Hawley was at South by Southwest, and he said that by the end of the season, people would have a better understanding of what Legion was trying to accomplish with a story. He's always been saying that in interviews, that by the end of the season, we would understand the questions raised throughout the series. So I don't know for sure to what detail, like, would that mean that we could go back and know exactly what was real and not the whole time? But he's always maintained that, you know, you're not going to have questions by the end of it. He also said Legion is meant to be a show that is a state of mind, but the problem with TV is that there are commercials. He said, there's a hypnotic quality to the way we put it together. I need to get you out of your life in the first 7 minutes of that show.
Yeah, that could also be, because I noticed this was a slightly longer than the average episode, slightly.
Mm-hmm.
And it had to commiserate more commercials, because we are watching this on FX now, and it's a real bummer because you can't fast forward or skip the commercials. So, like, it really does, like, you get the full live watch experience. And I think he might be onto something there. Because if this show is allowed to cast its spell on you and it kind of sucks you in, you're going to have a different reaction than if every 7 or 8 minutes you're pulled out and, you know, Geico shoves its gecko down down your dick hole. It definitely probably doesn't have that spell-like quality.
Can you try watching it 1 week a different way? Or does it not work with your schedule?
No, I mean, that's the thing. Like, the problem is we just don't have a DVR right now. Because we've kind of gone to this model where we get stuff on. I mean, I guess what we should have done is this available on like iTunes or Amazon?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's probably what we would do. Like if I was going to do this again, maybe do that.
I never watch it with commercials and I don't know what the difference is, but I can imagine it would be annoying.
Yeah. We just want to try to FX Now app and we just kind of see what that was all about. And it's like, it's just a bummer because you get to these, the place you can fast forward and rewind and pause during the episode, but there's these breaks where they just you just have to watch the commercials and you can't fast forward, pause, or do anything while those are playing.
It's very Black Mirror. All right.
How dare they try to pay for the free entertainment I'm consuming? Damn it.
Okay, so what was that listener-supported site again? Just kidding.
Exactly.
All right, time for next week on Legion. This is where it gets a little more spoilery. The first, American teaser wasn't all that spoilery. It had Carrie saying the hospital wasn't real, Sid saying it was a mental projection created by the monster, David's locked in that box, Oliver's back with Carrie in the frozen cube talking about rescuing David. But then there was this promo that I think was maybe shown on Canadian TV or something. Did you guys see it?
No, I saw it right before we sat down and record. I saw people talking about it on Reddit, but I didn't actually get a chance to see.
But you know
the commercial
said.
Sort of.
It said, so it has Oliver saying to Carrie, "You know who this is?" Carrie says, "Amal Farouk, the Shadow King."
Uh-huh. Huh. So they are, I mean.
All right.
Just straight up.
Confirmation.
Yeah, I knew that.
We
now,
kind of all knew it, yeah.
Yeah, how, you just said Carrie said it or Melanie?
Oliver.
Oliver said
I
that.
I think Carrie said it. Oliver said, you know who this is, and I could be wrong, but anyway, somebody said it. And then later Oliver says something about how David's hiding in a tiny corner of his mind, but he'd be gone soon. And then the Shadow King would become David.
It's so weird because like, is that a real spoiler? Because if you're not an X-Men fan, that's like, you know, it's like if you're watching episode one of Spider-Man and Peter Parker gets bit, and then the preview, they're like, you're going to become a Spider-Man. Like, if you don't know who Spider-Man is or what the hell, like, that could
or
mean anything.
You're watching Star Trek Into Darkness and the villain reveals that his name is Khan.
Right. Yeah. Like, okay. Yeah, like, unless you know who the hell Khan is and all that, then is that really a spoiler? Like,
no.
If his name was Tizzy Wizzy Bottom Fizzy.
He definitely would not have been a spoiler.
Right.
Right.
He'd just be like, that's a fucking cool ass name.
Definitely.
That's a handle. I wonder if it's available on the PlayStation Network.
But for the comic readers, it's a spoiler.
Yeah.
But is it? Because again, if you're a comic book reader, you should have picked up on everything they're laying down. That's what I'm saying. It's a spoiler and it's not.
Well, I'll move this to the front of the podcast when I do the editing.
Very front. Okay.
Well, no, because even like there's always the self-righteous spoiler phobe that, you
Let's
know.
Just call this episode, I am the Farouk the Shadow King.
Right.
Yeah. Lenny is the Shadow King.
Yeah.
The other thing is David's father, you know, it was revealed David's father gave him away. And if it's the X-Men universe, that is Professor Xavier. Just thought that was worth mentioning.
Right. Yeah. And I wonder, I mean, if you're a comic fan and that's a spoiler, then to the extent that you know anything about the Shadow King, then you would know all that history, right? So
yeah,
like it's a multifaceted spoiler. Now you've got the Charles Xavier as the dad thing. And I thought, I was going to talk about this in the spoiler section anyway, that like the fact that they were hammering home this dad's identity so hard and like almost like, you know, giving him his Obi-Wan Kenobi quality of trying to hide him from me, like that seems like it's pretty pretty confirmy that it's going to be.
Right. If it's not, know, it's weird. It's really weird.
And I don't know what that means, because if this is taking place in 2017 or 2016, then the Xavier School for Gifted Children should be out there. Well, you know, any way you slice it, like, it just feels like the way this show's trying to have it both ways, where mutants are a poorly understood phenomenon and there's like all these organizations, maybe this one organization popping up, and maybe Xavier's a competing part of it. But then it's also hard to, I don't know.
It's like that in the comics too. And sometimes some writers treat mutants as if they're more secret than, and others they're a little more publicly known. And, you know, it's hard to nail down exactly what the status is. But as time has gone on in the Marvel Universe, there have definitely been more and more groups of mutants popping up.
Right.
All right. That is it. I think this is our longest episode yet. And that's just fine. So thanks for listening, everybody. And we'll talk to you next week.
See you.
Bye.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. It prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/listen. That's forhers.com/listen. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.